He wasn't born in Texas, but it became a big part of his identity, remembering 41st President George Herbert Walker Bush today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm Laura Rice, in for David Brown. Airport security officials have recently found a record number of firearms in carry-on luggage. We'll take a look at the trend. Oil prices are up a little after a huge drop. What a high five between two world leaders tells us about what could be next for the industry. Plus, an investigation reveals what the state of Texas was trying to keep secret, where it gets its execution drugs. And we're collecting memories of George H.W. Bush from listeners across Texas and beyond today on the Texas Standard. From Massachusetts to Connecticut, Midland to Houston, Washington, D.C. to Kennebunkport, and all places in between. This is the Texas Standard for Monday, December 3rd. I'm Laura Rice, in for David Brown, and today we're remembering President George H.W. Bush. At this point, you well know that Bush died late Friday night at his home in Houston. He was 94. Many of us, though, didn't find out on Friday. We woke up to the information Saturday morning. While it wasn't a shock, perhaps, it's still shocking to see a page in history turn. Bush had a form of Parkinson's disease and had been in and out of the hospital recently. Some have opined that perhaps the true cause of his death was a broken heart. His wife of 73 years, Barbara, died less than 8 months ago. George H.W. Bush made politics and public service his life's work. He served in World War II and later built a career in the Texas oil industry. He was also, as we well know here in Texas, the patriarch of a political family, father to a president and former governor of Texas, and another generation of Bushes now serving in Texas government. Himself considered by many to have been the most successful one-term president, guiding the nation through a rough period in history. His legacy seemingly already largely apparent. Mark Updegrove is president and CEO of the LBJ Foundation and the author of The Last Republicans about both Presidents Bush. He spoke with Texas Standard host David Brown about the 41st president.
It's worth mentioning that George H.W. Bush, before he died, was at the center of more history than any living American, without question. He was in World War II.
A hero
in that war. Absolutely. Shot down. His two crewmates, Ted White and John Delaney, died, never emerged from the Pacific. He did, was rescued miraculously by a submarine that popped out, rescuing him from almost certain capture from the Japanese.
Amazing story.
So he was in World War II, one of the last and best of the greatest generation. Came here to Texas to get in the oil business, which was fledgling at the time, but which would boom. Later, when it went into Congress, he ran for the Senate twice in 64 and 70, defeated both times, but in between became a congressman. So he was in Washington during the Lyndon Johnson years, when the Great Society was being built by LBJ. Afterward, though, after having been defeated for that Senate seat in 1970 by Lloyd Benson, he went on to a series of appointments with Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford, and then comes back to the United States to be the director of the CIA before going on to a period of a few years in the political wilderness, and then running for president in 1980.
And people forget about that aspect, the fact that he ran for president in 1980. He wasn't a natural, it would probably be fair to say, he wasn't the most gifted campaigner, I suppose you could say.
No, he wasn't, but his experience spoke volumes.
Right,
I mean, he probably has had as much or more experience than any U.S. president that we've had. And there's a certain genuineness about George Bush. He made friends very, very easily. And I think that helped in states like Iowa and New Hampshire, where retail politics comes into play. Mm-hmm. People got to know not only him, but his wife, Barbara, and their family. And there's a sort of this infectious attraction that ensued. And he ran neck and neck with Ronald Reagan for a while, and then Ronald Reagan in New Hampshire beat him rather roundly.
Right.
And then rescues Bush from political obscurity by bringing him on to his ticket.
When he ran in 1988, Bush ended up carrying the nation, something like, I don't remember the final electoral victory, but it seems like it was something in the neighborhood of like 300 to 111 or something along those lines.
It was decisive, yeah.
Yeah, it was decisive.
Yeah, yeah.
And as you look at that presidency, here was a leader who, well, in his inaugural address, he made it clear that he was willing to project American political power. And in fact, fairly early on, you had the invasion of Panama. You had Somalia. You had, of course, the Persian Gulf War, example.
Yeah, he portended in that speech, probably his best political speech, the inauguration speech that he gave in 1989. He talks about a new breeze blowing throughout the world. Mm-hmm. And that portends the collapse of the Soviet Union and the fall of the Berlin Wall, or not in that order, but vice versa. It portends the new world order that would emerge during the course of his tenure as president. And frankly, the new world order that he would help to engineer as president.
It's funny, as I was looking back at some of the things that have been written about George Bush, before there was such a thing as a meme, George Bush had so many little lines that would end up being associated with him and in fact his presidency. One of them was new world order. Another one was a kinder, gentler nation. What did he mean by a kinder, gentler nation?
Well, I think just that. The during the Reagan years, we saw great prosperity. I think the rich got a lot richer. And a lot of the poor were left behind. We saw a tremendous spike in homelessness. The underclass grew. And it was something that we didn't talk about a great deal. AIDS was ravaging the United States and other parts of the world. That was unaddressed. I think Reagan mentioned the word AIDS once during the course of his presidency. What Bush was saying is we need to be more compassionate.
Was he sincere about those feelings, or were these political platitudes designed to sort of broaden the, open up the tent, if you will?
Well, I think they were certainly thrown out there to open up the tent, but they speak to the Bush ethos, the value set that you saw with George and Barbara Bush and that they inculcated in their children. And that was a decency, civility, humility, and putting service above self. He grew up in great privilege in Greenwich, Massachusetts, went to prep schools and went on to Yale.
Right.
This was a person who was not lacking in anything when he was growing up. You could say the same thing for Barbara Bush. At the same time, he learned lessons, particularly at his mother's knee. One was, you're not entitled to anything. You've been born on third base. You're lucky. And the importance of giving back. Also, she would constantly say, George, don't be a braggadocio.
When you think about George H.W. Bush, the person, especially in his later years, I know Barbara Bush used to joke about how he could run for John Boehner's seat because he, you know, would cry at the drop of a hat as he got older.
Yeah.
What sort of person was he? What was he like to be around?
Wonderful. He was absolutely delightful. Very humble. When you walked into George Bush's office, you weren't seeing a great man. You know, you weren't seeing this puffed up character. He was very, as I mentioned, he was very, very humble, a great storyteller, had a wonderful sense of humor, and just pleasant to be around, just a delight to be around.
Yeah, what accounts for the reports much later in life about, you know, him pinching the bottoms of women in photo opportunities and that sort of thing that came out just a few years ago?
You know, it doesn't square with his character. But it's something that he didn't deny. In fact, he was contrite about it, which you have to give him credit for. I think part of it was that he was in a wheelchair and his hands were in very awkward places when you know, people would get photographs with him. I'm not going to say that it was appropriate in any way, shape, or form, regardless of what generation you're from. But I don't think he saw it as egregious as it turned out to be.
Do you think that the allegations in a way hurt him or no? Is there any way of knowing how he reacted?
I don't know if they hurt him or not. I think he was a little surprised. He did say, I know, to his chief of staff, it's a great joke, isn't it? She said, no, we're not making that joke anymore. And I think he was making light of the situation, not because he didn't sympathize with those who he made the joke with, but I'm not sure he knew how to react.
Do you think he wanted his son to be president?
I don't think there's any question that he wanted his children to follow him into the arena. However, George Bush was not one to be heavy-handed as a parent. I think the Bush's parental philosophy was inculcate your kids, instill good values in your children, and let them find their way, support them. They revere public service over anything. And I think the highest expression in their view of public service is getting involved in politics, becoming an elected official. So when George Bush left the presidency in 1993, I think if he was not depressed, he was certainly deflated. That's what George W. Bush told me at a certain time. When his sons, Jeb and George W., both decided to run for their state houses in their respective states, Florida for Jeb, Texas for George W., I think it gave him renewed life.
Mark, as a historian, I wonder if you would take off your historian's hat for just a moment, and I wonder if you'd share with us some kind of personal reflection or memory that you have about President Bush. Maybe might be something related to getting to meet him or having conversations with him. Is there a moment that sort of stands out to you?
The memory that burns brightest for me is we were sitting in his very small and spare office in Kennebunkport. I was doing an interview for The Last Republicans, and we were so close our legs were touching, in fact, just the two of us. And I asked him if he would have taken the same course that his son took in Iraq. And he thought about it. And this is, of course, the question that every historian wants to know. And he hadn't talked about it until then. And he said, well, I don't know. He said that a lot. He said, well, I don't know. He said, but yeah, I think so. And at that moment, I didn't know if I was hearing the views of a former commander-in-chief or whether I was hearing a protective father. And I think it was probably the latter. It was a very touching and tender moment.
Mark Updegrove is the author of The Last Republicans. He is also president and CEO of the LBJ Foundation. Thank you so much for speaking with us on the Texas Standard. We appreciate you sharing your reflections of George H.W. Bush.
It's always a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
And we're hearing reflections from listeners out there as well. Texas Standard social media editor Wells Dunbar in the studio with us with some of them.
Yes, hi, Laura. We are hearing from our friends and listeners about the death of George H.W. Bush. Here's what some folks are saying on our Facebook page, facebook.com/Texas Standard there. Michael Hathoot calls him a decent and patriotic man. And Robert Bobby Flood says, although I did not agree with all his policies, I must admit he was a man of character for the Republican Party, and not just a character on reality TV. Laura, seeing a lot of people really bring up that contrast between Bush and the current inhabitant of the Oval Office, that really seems to be weighing pretty heavily on a lot of the reactions we're hearing. Like I said, we're seeing a lot of those reactions come in at Facebook, facebook.com/Texas Standard, and we're also on Twitter, twitter.com/Texas Standard, where we're getting more reactions. I'll be back with more from social media later in the show.
And we'll have a little more on President Bush's life and legacy as well, but a little other news coming up next. Stay with us.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, bringing cancer-fighting treatments and 300 open clinical trials to 26,000 patients in Austin each year so they have access to care near the support of their loved ones. More at texasoncology.com.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Laura Rice. Millions of people go through airport security every day. Passengers toss their water bottles, put their laptops in a bin, take off their shoes. But security is not just checking for computers and shampoo. Transportation Security Administration agents are finding a record number of firearms in carry-on luggage. As holiday travel heats up, Guns and America reporter Anthony Cave tries to explain why.
Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport is larger than Manhattan. That means multiple security checkpoints and plenty of carry-on baggage. TSA agent Crystal Cherry works at DFW. She carried me through Terminal A on a busy weekday afternoon. Passengers keep asking whether or not their jacket needs to go in a separate bin. It's cold outside. That slows things down, but it's nothing compared to when an agent finds a gun.
What happens is we will shut down a lane, and we will notify police airport. And so then they'll come, they'll take possession of the firearm, they'll interview the traveler with the firearm. And then at that point, it's pretty much in their hands. They'll issue any type of like civil penalties or anything at that point, if necessary.
TSA agents like Cherry found almost 4,000 guns at airports across the country in 2017. That's 50% more guns than they found in 2015. according to an analysis of federal data. No matter what, it's illegal to have a gun in your carry-on bag, and more than 85% of these guns are loaded. Almost a third are chambered, meaning ready to shoot.
It also kind of seems consistent, like the bigger the airport, the more passengers you get, and then the more you might see with firearms in their luggage.
The TSA says it's hard to speculate why agents find so many loaded guns in carry-ons. One reason? Americans carry a lot of guns.
A lot of people don't know you can't bring a gun on a plane. They get their concealed carry permit, and it doesn't say on that permit, can't carry this on a plane.
Jeff Price is the former assistant security director at Denver International Airport. Across the country, according to the Crime Prevention Research Center, more than 17 million people have a concealed handgun permit. And that's growing. So some people are used to carrying their gun in their purse or in their backpack, and they forget to take it out before going through the security checkpoint.
They're thinking about the hassle of getting through that process and getting on the flight, and do I have 3 ounces of liquids or not, and how long am I going to have to stand in this line? And actually, one of the thoughts they probably don't have is, oh, do I still have that firearm I threw in my laptop 6 months ago?
Carrying a gun in your carry-on luggage is a costly mistake. The TSA can levy more than $13,000 in fines for a single violation.
It really depends on the person. If they truly forgot it and realize they forgot it, the commotion more is they're apologetic all over the place because they know the consequences are going to start coming down on them.
So what happens if you get caught with a gun in your carry-on? It varies at each airport. Typically, airport police take possession of a weapon and then decide whether or not to file criminal charges. At DFW, you are allowed to take your gun back, but only if you have a license to carry and pass a background check. Without that license, police file a case with the local DA. Crystal Cherry, the TSA agent, says it is possible to fly with your gun, but only in checked baggage.
So you have to check it. It has to be unloaded, and it needs to be in a locked hard case bag, and then you need to let the airline know.
DFW consistently ranks among the top airports for guns found in carry-on baggage. The number one airport for guns is also the world's busiest, Hartsfield-Jackson in Atlanta. This holiday season, the TSA says to get to the airport early, regardless of whether or not you have a gun in your bag, and to check your bags when you pack them. For Guns in America, I'm Anthony Cave in Dallas.
Guns and America and our partners at KERA North Texas are spending 2 years reporting on the role of guns in American life. Find out more at gunsandamerica.org.
Support for coverage of Business on Texas Standard comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, ensuring compassionate care for injuries of every size at businesses big and small. Learn more at WorkSafeTexas.com.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. It's been a rough and tumble couple of months for the oil industry. After hitting 3-year highs back in early October, crude prices took a hit. West Texas Intermediate crude prices fell 22% in November, the biggest monthly loss in a decade. As of this morning, prices were up about 4.5% ahead of this week's OPEC meeting, with markets optimistic about potential production cuts. Here to give us a preview of what's ahead, energy insider Matt Smith. He's director of commodity research at Clipper Data. Matt, good to talk with you again.
You too. Thanks, Laura.
Oil prices have closed out November with their worst month since October of 2008. What's on the agenda at this week's OPEC meeting?
Well, as we've seen, WTI prices dip below that $50 level for the first time in a year. There are real concerns here for these OPEC members who need oil prices much higher to meet their budgets, which are for Saudi Arabia is $88 a barrel there. So there seems likely that we're going to see a production cut come through from OPEC and NOPEC when they meet on Thursday and Friday of this week. One thing actually that gave us some insight into that, I don't know if you saw this, but the Saudi Prince Mohammed bin Salman and President Putin of Russia giving each other a big high five when they met on Friday at the G20 meeting. I think that was somewhat a signal that we would have some decision coming through. So some optimism has started to build. And then that's been added to as well with news over the weekend that President Trump has managed to defer these trade concerns for 3 months. So all the stars seem to be aligning for a production cut coming through at the end of the week, and hence we're getting prices really rallying strongly here.
And so that high five then, an indicator maybe then that the Saudis are looking to cut production?
Yeah, so it's really Saudi Arabia that is likely going to be leading the charge here. That's what happened when we had the previous production cut, and we think that they're going to be leading it again. They are the largest producer, or one of the largest producers in the world, the largest exporter. And they want that price higher. We know this. And so because of all these factors, we think that they'll be the ones that are be pushing for this cut. And that was what was really signaled with the high five.
So is there a question, though, of whether they'll be able to convince others to come along with them to cut production?
There is. There was that challenge last time around. But given that they have so much sway, they will have to do much of that heavy lifting themselves. And so they'll be doing the lion's share of it. But then if they can convince Russia to take a chunk off the market as well, and then incrementally the other members of the cartel, you have got other countries as well in OPEC that just have production dropping anyway, such as Venezuela, Angola, just because of a lack of investment. Hmm. And so really, even if they don't get 100% consensus, if they can still get 80% or something like that, then that would be deemed a success, because taking as much as they can off the market is only going to support prices.
And quickly, how are producers here in Texas responding to all this oil news going into the new year?
$50 a barrel is a fairly key level for them, in that above that level, then, they continue to make investments. They're making good money. But once you drop below that level, then these concerns come in. They start to do less activity, less investment. It's at a time now when they're looking at their budgets for next year, and looking at an oil price of $50 a barrel versus $60 a barrel is going to be make them be that much more conservative. But on the flip side of all of this, you always have that the double-edged sword, in that gasoline prices in Texas have dropped 20% in the last couple of months, and they've probably got another 10% to go unless oil prices really rally from here.
Matt Smith is Director of Commodity Research for Clipper Data. Matt, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund and the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas, offering a pair of plans that can help families save toward college dreams. More at SaveNowForCollege.org.
From the Texas Standard Newsroom, I'm Becky Fogle with a roundup of news from across the state. Mexico, Texas's largest trading partner, officially has a new leader. The Texas Standard's Joy Diaz reports.
Mexico's President Andrés Manuel López Obrador was sworn in on Saturday. Among the U.S. delegation were Vice President Mike Pence, Senator John Cornyn, and the president's daughter, Ivanka Trump. López Obrador called their visit a gesture of goodwill. He also thanked Mexicans living abroad, saying their $30 billion in remittances are now Mexico's largest source of income. He said he's inheriting a country in shambles, but that a renaissance is coming.
Son tres cosas las que necesitamos para enfrentar la crisis de México, y dos de ellas están aseguradas.
Mexico needs three things to face its crisis, he said, and it already has two: a hardworking people and a wealth of natural resources.
Pronto, muy pronto, tendremos lo tercero: un buen gobierno.
And soon, very soon, he said, it will have the third: a good government. Andrés Manuel López Obrador is Mexico's 65th president, with a term of 6 years, but he has asked the people to rate his presidency after two, and if necessary, remove him from office. I'm Joy Diaz for the Texas Standard.
A former Dallas police officer who fatally shot her neighbor in his own apartment in September will be tried for murder. At the end of last week, a grand jury indicted 30-year-old Amber Geiger, who is white, for killing Botham Jean, a 26-year-old black man. Dallas County District Attorney Faith Johnson addressed the press Friday after the indictment was announced.
We did a full, complete presentation to the grand jury.
Johnson discussed the indictment alongside John's family, including his mother, Allison John. She thanked the district attorney's office for its work on the case.
I look forward to the next step, which is a conviction of murder of Amber Geiger, and more so, the proper penalty that will cause her to reflect on what she has done and the pain that she has caused.
District Attorney Johnson says it could be a year before Geiger's criminal trial begins. The Texas House Republican Caucus has endorsed State Representative Dennis Bonin as Speaker for the 2019 legislative session. The group announced the unanimous decision over the weekend. Bonin, who represents Angleton, said last month he had enough votes to secure the seat left vacant by retiring House Speaker and fellow Republican Joe Strauss. The Texas House officially elects a Speaker on the first day of the next legislative session, which begins January 8th. That's Look at News from across the state. I'm Becky Fogle for the Texas Standard.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm Laura Rice, in for David Brown. December is a critical time in the football calendar that this year has brought opportunities for some teams and controversy for others. Here to talk it over is Darren Roberts. He's the founding director of UT Austin's Center for Sports Leadership and Innovation and a former NFL and college coach. Darren, thanks as always for stopping by the Texas Standard Studios.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
The Kansas City Chiefs cut their star running back on Friday. They let go of Kareem Hunt after TMZ published a video of him assaulting a woman. Is it clear whether the league or the team knew about the assault beforehand?
So, you know, it seems that both the NFL and the organization knew of the incident. Hmm. And the reports that we're getting is that there were attempts to talk to the victim as well as to some of the other people that were there during the incident. The NFL did not have any contact with Kareem Hunt, so they did not interview Kareem Hunt. The Chiefs said that they did talk with him, and one of the reasons why they cut him is because what the video showed did not match up with what Kareem told them in August. And so, you know, in many ways, Laura, it feels like we are in 2014 and this is the Ray Rice episode all over again.
But now, was the action that the Chiefs took, though? I mean, is that a change?
Yeah, you know, I think what's interesting is that many people are pointing to the Chiefs' swift action in cutting Kareem as a sign that there has been some improvement. You know, I would just say that I don't know if the league needs to hire TMZ. The fact that an outlet like TMZ has effectively scooped the National Football League twice on very visible cases is somewhat troubling. It is unclear to what extent TMZ is going in order to access this video. But you would like for either the NFL or a team to get it before, you know, an outlet like TMZ.
Right. Do you think that Kareem Hunt will get another chance in the NFL?
I think it's going to be difficult. So Article 46 of the collective bargaining agreement sets the minimum suspension for domestic violence at a 6-game suspension. We saw this with Ezekiel Elliott, and that case did not have the sort of evidence we have here. Mm-hmm. I think that Commissioner Goodell will probably levy a penalty that will exceed 6 games. And there are varying reports around the league, but the consensus seems to be that it's going to be difficult for one of the other 31 teams to really justify claiming him off of waiver. So I think he won't play football for the next 2 years, and then we can just kind of see what happens in the future.
Well, we got the serious stuff out of the way. I want to talk about the college football now. Those successful teams rewarded with bowl games. The bowl schedule was announced yesterday, but not all bowls are created equal. Does getting invited to a more prestigious bowl, though, actually make any difference for a football program?
It does. You know, there's a lot of great capital that comes from being in a big-time bowl game. You take the January 1 bowl games. You know, if you're in the Rose Bowl, $4 million payout. The Orange Bowl has paid up to $6 million in the past. So that's a big-time payout for each team. But also the benefit of having 2 to 3 weeks of time to practice that your competitors don't have, many head coaches will point to that as really the main payout because you get some young freshmen and sophomores additional practice time. And then the visibility for recruiting. I mean, this will be, you look at the University of Texas taking on Georgia on the New Year's Day. All of the recruits will be watching this game. So there are a lot of benefits to being in a big-time bowl game.
Well, you mentioned UT in the Sugar Bowl. There's also Houston in the Armed Forces Bowl, TCU in the Cheez-It Bowl,
yeah.
Baylor in the Academy Bowl, A&M in the Gator Bowl. I think I got them all. Any reactions to where everybody else ended up?
You know, it's been interesting, I think, time for the state of Texas in terms of programs. Many people think that the state's a bit down in terms of performance, you know, but at least you have, you know, Texas in one of the main bowls. And
and Texas really almost had the chance to be in a playoff game. I mean, that's where Oklahoma finds themselves. Of course, Texas and Oklahoma had their rematch over the weekend. Any reactions from that game?
Yeah, you know, it's since 1903. You know, this is the first time that the teams have had a rematch since.
Wow.
And that's before Oklahoma was a state. So this doesn't happen every year. And you have to, you know, even as an alum and as a professor here at UT, you do have to tip your hat a little bit to OU for getting into the college football playoff. They have their work cut out for them in taking on the top team in the country in Alabama. But, you know, I think if you're game plan well and go in prepared, that there's an opportunity to maybe keep it close. So
Darren Roberts is the director of UT Austin Center for Sports Leadership and Innovation. Darren, always good to see you.
Likewise. Thank you, Laura.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Great Texas Line Press, publishers of Texas travel guides, cookbooks, and humor, including Speak Texan in 30 Minutes or Less, at Barnes & Noble, The Alamo, The Bullock, Amazon, Bucky's, and GreatTexasLine.com.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Laura Rice, in for David Brown. Today, the body of President George H.W. Bush is being flown from Houston to Joint Base Andrews in Maryland. From there, he'll be transported to the U.S. Capitol Building in Washington, D.C., where he's set to lie in state today through Wednesday. That's when his body will be taken to the National Cathedral for his funeral. Then he'll make one final trip back here to Texas. He'll be buried on the grounds of the Bush Presidential Library in College Station, next to his wife Barbara and their daughter Robin. The entirety of these flights will be aboard what's usually Air Force One, although this week it's being dubbed Special Mission 41. Texas first became home to George Herbert Walker Bush in 1948. He moved to West Texas right after finishing up at Yale with his wife Barbara and first son, George W., in tow. Bush worked for an oil company, then co-founded another. As his business grew, he took his growing family to Houston. But of course, we know Bush's career soon took a turn from oil to politics. As Lauren Silverman reports, the nation's 41st president helped build the Republican Party in Texas. The state was mostly blue when he arrived in the late 40s.
When Bush Sr. landed in Odessa, Texas, it wasn't his first time navigating a vast ocean of blue. Decades before, he'd fallen into the Pacific Ocean after being shot down by the Japanese. In World War II, he fought to knock down a foreign enemy. At home, he fought to pump up the GOP.
Bush was a pioneer in building the Republican Party in Texas.
SMU professor Carolyn Barta covered Bush's campaigns and presidency as a reporter.
Back in the 50s, when he was in Midland, he was a precinct chairman. And the Republicans used to joke back then that there were so few Republicans in Texas they could meet in a phone booth, if anybody remembers what a phone booth is.
Bush moved his family to West Texas in 1948 to get into the oil business, not public life. The Yale graduate bought a little house in Midland in 1950 in a development nicknamed Easter Egg Row. Back then, Midland was a small, close-knit community.
When the weather's kinda chilly and we start to kiss and hug, everybody thinks she's...
Hank Williams was number one on the country charts. Bush built a network in the oil fields, started his own oil company, and raised six children, one of them a future president. After becoming a millionaire, Bush turned to public life.
He came in at a time where the Republican Party was still the minority party in the state.
Jonathan Nierman is a former chairman of the Dallas County Republican Party. Nierman says it was after Bush moved from Midland to Houston that his political career picked up speed. In 1962, Bush became chairman of Harris County, and his role as a party builder began. First, Nierman says, he embraced the radical right. Then he picked off Democrats angry about integration.
And blending them in with the traditional moderate Republican base was a very difficult thing. And that is echoes. I mean, you look at today's Republican Party, and it's the same issues that party chairmen are facing today.
At the end of the day, Bush understood a political party is a medley of different groups.
And you have to find enough issues that can build a coalition that would allow you not only to win elected office at the local level, but on the statewide and the national level as well.
So what issues did he run on? What were the issues he found that would help unite and not tear apart?
Early on, it was certainly economic issues, you know, helping the economy. It was sort of a pushback of the FDR New Deal policies.
In 1964, Bush jumped into a U.S. Senate race against incumbent Democratic Senator Ralph Yarborough. Although he ran tough, Bush couldn't overcome charges of being a carpetbagger. Next came a successful run for Congress, and then another Senate loss in 1970.
In running both of those races, what Bush did was he built an organization across the state.
SMU's Carolyn Barta says he also helped redirect the party.
The backbone of the Republican Party then were the Republican women volunteers. They were housewives looking for something to do. They got involved in Republican politics.
These women, known as Bush Belles, would show up at campaign events in red, white, and blue, silk-like scarves. Even after Bush left for Washington, the Belles, many of whom came from Dallas, continued to rally for Republican candidates. Bush also knew how to court reporters.
He was really accessible to the Texas press in whatever job that he had. And I think he recognized that one way to grow the party was to get more coverage for Republicans, because there weren't a lot of Republicans out there doing things then. And he was just a very genuine person. He was who he was, a New Englander who became a Texan by choice, but he was always who he was.
Long before she was senator, Kay Bailey Hutchison got to know Bush as a reporter for the NBC station in Houston.
George Bush became such a favorite of the press because he was so much fun and lighthearted. He would tell a lot of jokes and say what he thought, but in a very articulate, nice way.
Hutchison took careful notes, and during her two decades in office, she followed Bush's lead as a consensus builder herself. Meanwhile, Bush would serve as ambassador to the United Nations, chairman of the Republican National Committee, and CIA director. In 1980, after losing the presidential bid to Ronald Reagan, he finally landed a White House office as vice president. Nierman says that's when he put together an extensive Rolodex.
The vice president oftentimes has to attend ceremonial events, whether it's the opening of this, you know, embassy overseas or attend this foreign leader's funeral. You go to so many of those, you naturally have to build relationships overseas. You naturally come into the White House as president with this built-in advantage of knowing who these people are. And that's something that we really lose when we elect governors or, you know, one-term senators who run as outsiders. They may have wonderful qualities, but they can't come close to that sort of international experience that President Bush had.
And Nierman says Bush's presidential legacy is defined by his overseas achievements.
And now with reform underway in the Soviet Union, we stand at the threshold of a brand new era of U.S.-Soviet relations.
Shortly after Bush took office, the Berlin Wall fell. And 2 years later, his bombers struck the Persian Gulf. After the coalition victory in the Gulf, Bush addressed a joint session of Congress in 1991. He thought he could finally turn to domestic policy.
If our forces could win the ground war in 100 hours, then surely the Congress can pass this legislation in 100 days.
At home, though, a recession intruded, and in 1992, he lost the job to Bill Clinton. He returned to Texas, mostly staying out of politics, at least until his son, George W., ran for governor and ultimately president. Jonathan Nierman says there's been a transformation in Republican candidates since Bush Sr. Today, they embrace the label outsider. Bush 41 was the ultimate insider.
He had already been a World War II war hero, a U.S. congressman, a failed Senate candidate, CIA director, RNC chairman, UN ambassador, and ambassador to China. This is a man who had a tremendous amount of public experience And so I don't know that we'll see another man like him or woman like him in the Republican Party for years to come.
By building relationships and uniting a disparate Republican Party, Bush showed how to create lasting coalitions and helped turn Texas ruby red. From KERA in Dallas, I'm Lauren Silverman for the Texas Standard. Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to deliver business by design project management solutions to help cross-functional teams monitor projects in real time. More at softwareaspromised.com.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Laura Rice, in for David Brown. Tomorrow, Texas is set to execute Joseph Garcia. He's scheduled to be the 12th inmate to be put to death in 2018. The state, of course, has had issues maintaining supply of pentobarbital. That's the sedative it uses for lethal injections. Drug manufacturers won't let their products be used for executions, so the doses that the state are able to get come from compounding pharmacies. Texas tries to keep those pharmacies a secret. But an investigation from BuzzFeed News has identified one of those pharmacies, and it appears to have a spotty safety record. For more, we turn to Chris McDaniel. He is investigative reporter for BuzzFeed News. Chris, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit about this pharmacy.
So this is a pharmacy called Green Park Compounding Pharmacy, and it's a pharmacy in Houston, Texas. And for the past few years, it's been helping the state of Texas make at least some of its execution drugs. This is also a pharmacy whose license has been on probation for the past couple of years. It's on probation because it got caught by state regulators giving the wrong drug to three children accidentally, sending one to the hospital.
And that sounds like a pretty severe safety violation. Is that the main one, or did you find others as well?
We found a lot of others as well. In inspection documents over the past 8 years that we obtained, they've been cited 48 times by state regulators. They've also been inspected by the Food and Drug Administration, and the Food and Drug Administration cited them for a few things, warning them that their practices are putting patients at risk.
So many pharmacies refuse to supply pentobarbital. Do we know why Green Park was doing so, or why the state chose this particular pharmacy?
That's a really good question, and it still remains a mystery. Hmm. I contacted a lot of people at Green Park trying to figure that out, and they would not talk with me. They would not answer my questions about why they got involved or talk with me about the story that we were doing. The head pharmacist, when I called him up, he would only say, "I don't do it. I don't do it." When I followed up and said, "You know, you keep saying your denial is worded a little bit weirdly. Are you saying you don't do it or you've never done it?" Hmm. He said he needed to go and hung up.
Well, and that's an interesting question, right? Because we know the state does have a certain supply, but is this an ongoing relationship? Are they continuing to get this drug from them?
So they have recently. Mm-hmm. What remains to be seen is if they're going to continue that relationship into the future. They filed a declaration under a pseudonym in court saying, if our identity ever gets out, we aren't going to continue this relationship. Hmm. Obviously, now their identity is out. It remains to be seen if they're going to follow through with that and actually stop supplying execution drugs or not.
Now, Texas has given certain reasons as to why they don't identify the pharmacies,
right.
and perhaps this is one, because we can be critical of the pharmacy and its safety
right.
record. What are other concerns? I mean, is the pharmacy itself concerned about being targeted by protesters or by other people?
Sure. This pharmacy and others are worried mostly about boycotts mm-hmm. and, you know, financial problems resulting from this. And that's really their biggest concern. And that's one of the reasons that the state wants to keep this information secret. Unfortunately, obviously, keeping this information secret allows the state to contract with some pretty questionable suppliers like this one. And without this oversight, they've been able to do it for the past 3.5 years, potentially with some really terrible outcomes. You know, in 5 of the 11 executions Texas has had this year, the inmates, as they are dying, are talking about how the drug is burning, going through their veins, mm-hmm. which would indicate that there's a problem with how it's being mixed. And of course, with this pharmacy's regulatory history, you can see that this is something that state and federal regulators have actively been worried about and warning them about.
Chris McDaniel is investigative reporter for BuzzFeed News. We'll have a link to his latest at texasstandard.org. Chris, thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. Texas Standard social media editor Wells Dunbar is back in the studio now. He's been keeping an eye on all things Facebook and Twitter and making news out there. What you seeing, Wells?
Hey, Laura. Well, as we've been discussing on the show, George H.W. Bush died over mm-hmm. the weekend at the age of 94, and people are talking about his legacy, what his passing means, and the way it's being covered. And one thing I mentioned earlier where it was how many people remarking on Bush's death are contrasting his approach to the presidency with the current inhabitant mm-hmm. of the White House, one Donald Trump there. And as we mentioned earlier, Bush's deciding to run in Texas ultimately set in motion the Republican rule that we're really only beginning now to see slightly falter here in Texas. Well, one of our listeners has picked up on that via Facebook. Kay Garth says, if Bush helped build the Republican brand, then Trump has completely decimated it and helped morph it into a creature that now thrives on pathological lies and social discord. Another perspective here from Brad Emmons. He writes, I wonder if some on the left would be sainting Bush like this if Trump hadn't happened, if those distinctions hadn't been drawn as fully, I guess you could say, Laura. And Brad similarly wonders if the right will show the same deference when Bill Clinton passes. Interesting question there for sure. Donald Trump, you know, a polarizing figure, obviously. And I guess there might have been a little question about what was his role going to be with regard to paying respects to the president and things like that. It's been said that he is going to appear there, and then a tweet from the president while we were on the air. He said, looking forward to being with the Bush family to pay my respects to President George H.W. Bush. So,
leaving no question, he will be at the funeral with Melania at his side.
No question whatsoever. Another story that has folks talking, one we heard more about earlier in the news roundup, the former Dallas police officer who fatally shot her own neighbor in his own apartment back in September, she's going to be tried for murder.
Right.
On Friday, we learned that a grand jury indicted Amber Geiger for killing Botham Jean, a 26-year-old black man. And via our Facebook page, Christopher Bart says this case is interesting for a lot of reasons. Race, gender, police involvement, lots of biases potentially at play. What if the officer was male? What if the victim was white? What if she hadn't been an officer? Mm-hmm. I've heard a lot of people raise similar questions to that. So they're just a whole heck of a bunch to unpack with this story. And another really interesting aspect that some people are remarking on, Laura, is the fact that this is such a rarity to see a police officer indicted on a murder charge like this.
I mean, such a strange circumstance, though, too. You know, I mean, she wasn't on duty. She wasn't pulling someone over. You know, I mean,
and conflicting accounts of like what happened, whether or not she just walked in or banged on the door. Mm-hmm. So hopefully, the jury can get to the bottom of all that stuff. Well, in much happier news, Hanukkah is here. Hanukkah 2018 began yesterday evening.
I did some of that dreidel spinning over the weekend.
Nice.
So,
you know, you weren't the only one. Other folks celebrating as well. Gabriella Trunkman on our Facebook page says she is getting ready. And fascinating here, she says, next year my family marks 200 years in Texas. Despite what you think, many of us were stealth Jews, she calls them, had to keep their faith hidden because it was Spain then, and we remember the Inquisition.
Yeah.
So fascinating stuff. Salute to Gabriella and her family. And Hanukkah ends the evening of Monday, December 10th, so get to celebrate,
folks. All right, happy Hanukkah to those out there celebrating, and happy Monday to just all of you. We thank you so much for joining us here, and we'll see you back tomorrow here on the Texas Standard.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Wooldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.
PRI.
Public Radio International.